I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Harold Mackey, who is a world-famous food scientist and author of On Food and Cooking, which has influenced many chefs and home cooks since it was published in 1984. Hello, Harold. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Akio.
So, according to your website, curiouscook.com, you write about the science of food and cooking, such as where our foods come from, what they are made of, how cooking transforms them, and how to enjoy them. So how did you start this fascinating job?
Completely by accident. So I started out wanting to be a professor of English literature.
Wow.
And studied and got my degrees and taught for a couple of years. But I wasn't able to find just the right job, one that would give me the possibility of tenure. Meanwhile, I was recently married, and my wife had her career to think about, and she wanted to know what was going on with my teaching. And I said, well, not so much, so why don't you get a good job, and I'll try to do something portable. And writing about the science of food turned out to be the portable thing that I chose first. And it worked well enough that I stuck with it.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Right. But it's, you know, but you cannot just like wake up in the morning and let's go think about the food science, especially from English literature.
Yes. So before I studied literature, I did study science and wanted to be an astronomer. So my path has taken some funny turns along the way. And I thought about writing about the science of food as a way to kind of recoup my investment in science and write about something that was much more everyday. So astronomy is about sort of the nature of the universe. And this was more what happens in your kitchen every day when you get home from work. I wasn't sure that there was a lot of information about that subject, but I soon discovered that there was. It's just that no one really knew about it except professionals in food technology.
Okay.
And so I thought my job would be to translate the literature on food technology into the kitchen.
Right, because everybody has kitchen questions.
Yes, yes.
Right. And so you have now three publications, and the first one is On Food and Cooking. That was published in 1984 and it revised in 2004. And the second is The Curious Cook, More Kitchen Science and Lore. And the third one, Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best Food, Best of Foods and Recipes. So what is the theme of each book and what our listeners can learn from it?
Well, the first one on food and cooking, which is, as you say, revised in 2004, is kind of encyclopedic. So it's about 1,000 pages long, and I try to explain what most ingredients that people in the United States would come into contact with. What are they? How do we use them? How do they behave in the kitchen? And that kind of thing. So it's a sort of information about the background of ingredients and cooking techniques.
Right. I actually own the revised version, and it's about 900 pages. And you find everything, I think, of. It's very impressive, including a lot of Japanese ingredients, too.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I the first time around, I didn't pay that much attention actually to the traditions of other cultures. When I revised it, that's something that was at the top of my priority list, was making sure to look at cuisines in Asia and South America.
Yeah. It must be a lot of work because that you know, like 30 years in between. 20 years in between, that must be really a lot of progress in terms of American people's knowledge and curiosity about food.
That's exactly right. Yeah, the American public had gotten so much more interested in food, and then at the same time, they were becoming more familiar by traveling and so on, and the food scientists were doing a lot more work, and so what we knew about different things got deeper and deeper and deeper. Mm. So yes, it was quite a labor, but a labor of love.
Right. And the second book, The Curious Cook, More Kitchen Science and Lore?
Yes, and that's a very short book. I didn't want to do another very, very long one right away. And it's a book of experiments. So when I was doing the first book, I realized that food scientists and food technologists had not really answered all of the questions that come up in a home or a restaurant kitchen. Mm. And so there were many questions I still had. And so I went into the kitchen and started to do my own experiments to try to understand what was going on. And Curious Cook is the story of those experiments to help cooks understand that if they have questions, they can answer them themselves just by thinking a little and doing a couple of, the way I like to put it is you can play with your food, which our parents always told us not to do, but you can actually, you can learn a lot when you play.
Right. And I have some examples from the book. Does searing meat really seal in juices? The answer is no. And how much oil can you emulsify into mayonnaise with one egg yolk, gallons? And why does frying sputter end up on the inside surface of the cook's eyeglasses? Gravity.
Yes. Uh-huh.
That's amazing. Right. And the third one, the keys to good cooking.
And that's the most practical book that I've done. So it's instead of explaining why things are the way they are or what they are, it explains how to do things.
Okay.
So it's just lots and lots of information about the how to make particular dishes and what the best choices are when you have choices.
Mm. So you have one chunk of meat and what am I going to do? I don't know what to do. So you go to that guidebook.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. And you also had a column in New York Times for 5 years called The Curious Cook, which I was always looking forward to reading.
Uh-huh.
So what was it?
Well, it was kind of more of the same in the experimental vein from the book that I wrote called Curious Cook. So it's the editor asked me to just continue those kinds of investigations, sort of look into things that people wonder about or maybe haven't wondered about that have interesting aspects to them, and then write a 1,000 words every month.
Okay. Yeah, I think that kind of inspired people to think about food more scientifically. That was my impression.
Uh-huh.
Right. So what is your motivation for you to educate people about food science?
Well, basically because I think it's really cool. it's useful because the more you understand about anything, the more you can control what you're doing, the better job you can do. And that's true if you're a painter or a mechanic or an engineer. So there's that basic level. The more you understand, the better you can do things. But also, I think it's just fascinating because food is such an important part of our lives, both for nourishment but also for pleasure.
Mm.
And so understanding where these things come from and how different cultures have taken the same material and found such different ways to make them delicious, I think that's just cool.
Right. And now the food science is becoming more and more important, and not just for chefs but home cooks. So why do you think this trend came?
Well, I think it's part of a much larger trend, which is the general interest in food. So I grew up in the 1950s and 1960s when, of course, there was food, but it was all kind of the same and not that interesting. And we weren't really, I grew up in the Midwest. We didn't really have much in the way of ethnic foods. And I think it was in the 70s that people really began to realize that there was this wonderful world out there that they could be enjoying. And their interest in food science, I think, came along with that. It's part of the fascination with the diversity of ingredients there are and the diversity of styles of cooking. Mm. And then cooks started to do more interesting things, and they needed to understand better what the ingredients can do in order to be creative. So I think it was lots of different things, all basically having to do with the fact that we, as a planet, rediscovered how interesting food is.
And also the TV media, like Food Network, and those. And I think also the, you know, the Spanish, new Spanish cuisine, molecular gastronomy, maybe that's another big push.
I think that's true. There's one chef in Spain who became famous for his innovation, which had never been true before. Mm-hmm. Chefs were known for their skill in making traditional dishes of one kind or another, or making kind of minor creative moves within a framework that was very familiar, like French cooking. And then Ferran Adrià comes along and says, I'm going to do things that you've never seen before, and I'm going to do something different every year. And that really got people's attention.
Right. And now let's talk about Japanese food. So on this show, we talked about many traditional Japanese food items, but we have not discussed them scientifically. So first, what is umami?
Umami is a taste that was only confirmed to be a taste very recently, like 20 years ago. And it's a long and interesting story, but basically until the turn of the 20th century, most people thought we had four tastes, sweet, sour, salt, and bitter. And then a Japanese scientist working in Tokyo discovered that there was something in kombu, in seaweed, that he thought made a different taste altogether. And again, to make a long story short, it took 100 years for the rest of science to catch up with him and agree that was the case.
Okay. Yeah, people tend to think that umami is only in Japanese food, but it's found in tomatoes, parmigiano, and potatoes, mushrooms, everything Western.
Yes, well, lots of things Western, and I think that's part of the reason that it was a Japanese scientist who discovered umami, because something like Parmesan or tomato is such a complicated flavor. It's got acidity, it's got saltiness, it's got fruitiness. In the case of cheese, all kinds of other things, animal flavors going on. Whereas a broth made from seaweed is just a broth made from seaweed. You can pick out the taste of umami much more easily in something as simple as that.
It's more pure form of umami.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. So I heard that also the umami enhances saltiness, sweetness, so that's why parmigiano gets even more tasty. And I think kind of dashi, the kombu is used to enhance other whose flavors.
Yeah, so in the case of many of the Western foods that have umami, they're fermented. So, and what happens in that process is that the proteins are broken down into their building blocks, which are amino acids, and glutamate is one of those. And so milk doesn't have much umami flavor, but you ferment it and let the proteins break down for a year, and now all of a sudden you've got a lot of glutamate and a lot of umami.
Right. And I heard there are many different kinds of umami from different sources. For instance, mushroom and kombu has different kinds of umami. So what kinds of umami exist?
So it turns out that umami is a somewhat complicated flavor because there are three different groups of chemicals. And all flavor, by the way, is chemistry. Mm-hmm. So it's not saying anything bad to say that there are three groups of chemicals. Mm-hmm. There's glutamate, MSG, which everyone's heard of. But then there are two other groups with scientific names. One of them tends to be found more in seafood and mm-hmm. shellfish and things like that, scallops and mm-hmm. oysters and things. And then the other group tends to be found in mushrooms.
Okay.
And so because they're three different things, they can complement each other. They can synergize with each other. Mm-hmm. And so just MSG by itself will have one level of umami. But then if you add mushrooms or if you add scallops, mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden it gets boosted by several times.
Okay. So what's the example of the... So that, you know, the one... found in shellfish, that's succinic acid?
There's that, and inosinic acid as well, yes.
Okay, uh-huh. Right. And what's the combination? Like, you know, you can create the synergy, for instance, what kind of food?
Well, kombu is actually, dashi is a great example, because mm-hmm. you start with kombu, which has lots of glutamate, and then you add to it katsuobushi, which is fermented fish, mm-hmm. and it's got lots of inosinates. And so the combination is much more mm-hmm. mouth-filling and much more delicious than just kombu.
Right. So traditionally in Japan, that's naturally people combine the bonito and so dried fish also. So
yes.
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And also I heard mirepoix and beef, kind of beef stew, that's also another example of the synergy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a little bit different. Mushrooms will provide that. Mirepoix, yeah, the mushroom part of mirepoix will contribute something different than the beef itself can contribute.
Okay.
That's right, yeah.
Right.
And the longer aged the beef is, the mm-hmm. better, because, again, you break down the proteins and get the building blocks.
Mm. Okay. And as I said earlier, so the aging or fermenting the food can increase the amount of umami. So I was thinking of miso. And I found the data. So the 100 grams of tomatoes contain 246 milligrams of the glutamate.
Uh-huh.
And if it's dried... dried tomato contains 648 milligrams in 100 grams of dried tomatoes. So uh-huh. that's really like tripled. Right?
Yeah, right. That's concentration. That's why dried things of all kinds, kombu, katsuobushi, tomato, mm-hmm. mushrooms also.
Right.
When you dry them out, you basically get rid of all the water. And mm-hmm. so all the flavorful things get that much more concentrated.
Okay. Right. So same as aged Parmesan, Parmigiano cheese, because it's concentrated.
Exactly. When you make cheese, the first step really is to make curds and whey. So you coagulate some to make the curds, and then you remove the whey, and the whey is all the extra liquid.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So now, the same way, aged product, that's miso, which is an essential flavoring in Japanese cuisine. So what is it, and how is it made?
So things like miso and soy sauce and sake, to me, these are just miracles. They're just amazing. preparations that were discovered back when no one knew anything really about what exactly is going on. And then it turns out that what's going on is really complicated and interesting. But basically what you do to make miso is you start with soybeans mm-hmm. and you start with separately a batch of rice. And you encourage to grow on the rice a particular kind of mold, a little bit like the mold that makes blue cheese,
okay.
except it's a very specific mold for these kinds of processes. So you get the mold growing on the rice, which is lets the mold grow very quickly. And then you cook the soybeans, soak them and steam them, and then you mix the rice with the mold together with the soybeans, And you basically let it sit for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And over that time, the mold does that breaking down process. It okay. starts with the proteins, which is our big molecules, starches, which are big molecules, mm-hmm. and breaks them down into their building blocks, which are really full of flavor and mm-hmm. really delicious.
Right. And also I heard that soybeans themselves are very high in umami in the first place. So miso is a umami-rich food.
Yes.
Right. And, you know, some miso have dark colors. So that's, I heard, from a Maillard reaction.
Yes. So there are lots of different kinds of miso, and each one is made in a slightly different way. And if you make miso at very cool temperatures for a long, long time, then it stays relatively pale mm-hmm. and has a kind of delicate fruity flavor. Mm-hmm. But if you raise the temperature so that you're doing the fermentation at something more like a hot summer day in Brooklyn, then it's hot enough for because you're doing it for such a long time, a form of cooking takes place. So when we cook something in a frying pan at a very high temperature, very quickly it turns brown. Mm. If you cook something at 100 degrees Fahrenheit for months, mm. you get the same kind of browning happening.
Right.
And so that's why the higher temperature misos are darker.
Mm. And sometimes dark, I sense more toastiness.
Yes, the flavor changes just as it does in the frying pan. You know, it's the difference between a boiled food and a fried food is that wonderful layer of browned flavor, and you get the same thing in miso. So the flavor in miso gets much more complex than just providing umami.
Okay.
It provides all kinds of wonderful flavors.
Right. Yeah. So our listeners can maybe basically look at the color of miso, and they can imagine. If it's lighter, it's more fruity, and it's darker, it's more toasty.
Yes,
muddy.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Right, okay. And I have a question about MSG, which is known as artificial version of umami, you know, in the general term. And it's also known as the cause of Chinese restaurant syndrome, in which I heard distressing sensations of burning pressure and a chest pain suddenly strike susceptible people who begin a Chinese meal with MSG-laden soup. Is it dangerous to use artificial MSG? Because, for instance, when I grew up, Ajinomoto, which is a granulated form of MSG, was always at the dinner table. So it's kind of scary to me.
Well, you know, Ajinomoto was developed, in fact, by the scientist who discovered umami in 1908.
Right, Mr. Kikunae Ikeda.
Yes,
right.
Yes. Basically, what he did was he said, this is the active ingredient in seaweed that makes this wonderful flavor. But seaweed tastes like seaweed also. Mm-hmm. So what if you would like to add that flavor to something where you don't want seaweed flavor? So mm-hmm. what he did was he made a purified version, just like table salt is a purified version of seawater. Mm. He just concentrated the important part of it and then gives it to you as an alternative to using kombu or miso or whatever more complex form of umami you might choose to use. So it's just another form to get that taste. And hundreds of studies have been done all over the world about the health effects because it is such a common ingredient in processed foods. So every country wanted to know, is this okay? Are we killing our citizens? And every study has come up with the answer, no. It's in the amounts that we have it in the food, it's very innocuous. In fact, it's a part of our own bodies.
Mm. Okay. Sounds like I can live a little.
Yes.
Okay, right?
Yes.
Right. All right. Now let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about kokumi, that's the sixth taste after umami. So please stay with us.
And this break song is called One Summer's Day by Kido. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Harold Mackey, who is a world-famous food scientist and author of On Food and Cooking, which has influenced many chefs and home cooks since it was published in 1984. So we've been talking about umami, but I read your 2012 article about kokumi, which is the additional to the five basic tastes, sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and umami. So it's a sixth taste. So what is it?
Well, after umami was confirmed to be another taste very recently, then taste scientists began to ask the question, I wonder if there are other tastes that we haven't been aware of, that we haven't been paying attention to. And so they began to look for aspects of food that gave you a sensation that wasn't one of the tastes that we already know. And one of them that they came up with, again in Japan, is a taste that they've called kokumi, which is sometimes described more as a kind of feeling in the mouth rather than a taste like saltiness or acid. And it's a feeling of kind of fullness, and also a feeling that the flavors of the food last in your mouth longer than they do without these components of the food.
So that time element normally is never captured by words in the past. So what kind of a food has kokumi?
Well, it turns out that the compounds that they have found that have kokumi effects are kind of relatives of glutamate, MSG, but instead of being just one building block, they're two or three put together. So again, they're breakdown products from proteins, which means that the same foods that tend to have a lot of umami also tend to have a lot of kokumi. So tomatoes and cooked things of various kinds, fermented foods of various kinds, miso, Parmesan cheese, same suspects, same usual group of foods, but a slightly different aspect to their flavor.
So the article I found, you tasted a tomato sauce, cheese-flavored potato chips, butter cookies, and cinnamon cookies, and chocolate. So which one was most prominent in kokumi?
It was actually the broth, I think because it was the simplest. I think the sweet things, I didn't notice the effect so much. But because this is something that people have only just begun to explore, it may be that there are four or five building block long things that will have similar or complementary effects.
Okay, right. So it may not be independent. It has to be with other taste elements.
That's right, yes.
Interesting.
Which, by the way, is also true of umami. Umami by itself, if you just have a little water and it's an experiment people can do. It's very easy. Just a little water with a little bit of MSG in it. It doesn't taste very good. But if you add a little salt and a little bit of lemon juice or something like that, then it starts to get very nice.
Okay. Right. So it's enhanced and enhances.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Okay. And now, I think there's another umami food in Japanese cuisine, which is natto. And we had a guest who makes natto in New York before, so whose name is Anu Yonetani. And she actually mentioned your name because you like her natto. So what is natto? And, because it has a very distinctive smell, loved or hated, and it's very gooey. So where does the smell and the stickiness come from?
Yeah, so it's a bit like miso in that you start with soybeans, but it's very, very different. The biggest difference is that you use a different microorganism to ferment the natto, and it only takes a day or so. At a relatively high temperature rather than months and months and months, which is what miso takes. So you steam soybeans and then you inoculate them, that is mix them with a culture of natto organism, which is a bacterium, not a mold. And then you wrap the the mixture, and you keep it nice and warm, kind of body temperature, mm-hmm. for a day or so. And then when you come back, these beans that were once just like ordinary cooked beans have now gotten really sticky and gooey on the outside, and they've turned brown, and they have this very interesting, to me anyway, aroma. Mm-hmm. And so what the microorganism has done, the bacillus, is to, again, break down some of the proteins in the soybeans, and soybeans are very rich in proteins, mm-hmm. and they've turned some of the protein into the sticky stuff that you see, mm-hmm. Which is has a little bit the consistency of egg white.
Okay.
So what you then do to eat it, because if you dip your chopsticks in and just kind of pull up, you end up with these long strings. They can be 3 feet, 4 feet, however high you can raise the chopsticks, and that's very difficult to eat. So what you do is you mix with your chopsticks maybe a little mustard or scallions or something like that with the natto, and you end up making kind of like a meringue, because the protein strands trap the bubbles of air, and you end up with this very interesting texture, which is the beans themselves, kind of sticky coating, and then this sort of bubbly stuff as well.
Right. And you said that, you know, that bubbly stuff is the umami.
It carries some of the umami. So the protein strings that make it sticky are made from the same amino acid, glutamic acid, that umami comes from. So they're related. But in those long strings, the umami isn't free, so you don't taste it.
Right. Okay. So, and, you know, like we before the show, we talked that, you know, not the people think stinky, but we agreed it's a coffee and chocolate toasty taste.
Yeah, for most people, and for most kinds of natto. Again, there are variations, mm-hmm. and I know that Ann Yonatani has experimented with different natto cultures to see which ones have the nicest aromas. So anyway, people who don't like it, who've just tried it once, they should try it again.
I agree. Right. And so I heard that the Japanese sake has a very unique fermentation process called multiple parallel fermentation. So you can scientifically explain here. And what is it, and how does it affect the taste of sake?
Uh-huh. Well, one way to think about it is to compare it with what happens in winemaking. So when you make wine, you start with grapes, which have a lot of sugar, and you add yeast, and you just put it in a barrel and you let it sit. And you don't have to do anything to it. The yeasts turn the sugar into alcohol in a continuous process, and it can get up to maybe 15% alcohol before the yeasts get drunk, and they can't make any more alcohol than that. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the natural maximum. In the case of making sake, the people who make sake can get to alcohol levels more like 20%, much, much higher. And that's because they do the fermentation very differently. Sake is made from rice, and rice is starchy. It's not sugary the way grapes are. So you have to turn the starches in rice into sugars so the yeasts can make alcohol.
Right, versus grapes, always this sugar.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So you have to have basically two fermentations going on to make sake. You have to have a fermentation that turns the starch into sugar, and then a fermentation that turns the sugar into alcohol. And if you do that in stages, so that you start with one batch of rice and you have these the two different cultures, the yeast and the starch-breaking culture, the koji, going at the same time, then they work together in parallel. So that's where the parallel comes from, until they get to a certain level of alcohol. But then if you refresh them by adding another batch of rice and another batch of koji, then the process starts up again, keeps going, and goes to a higher alcohol level. Mm. And if you do it three times, you can get up to about 20%.
Right. So that two-step fermentation happens in beer making too, because it's the grain converted to, you know, the starch and grain converted to sugar and then alcohol. So, but in case of sake, it's in the same, at the same time, in the same container. So it's kind of like more many things going on. And I heard it makes every taste more complex compared to other beverage.
Yeah, and the thing about making something like beer is that there actually is no second fermentation. What you do is you get the grains themselves to break down their own starch into sugar. That's the malting step.
Right.
And so making sake style wines is just a totally different process and gives you totally different results.
Mm. Okay. And there's a byproduct of sake making that's called sake lees. So what is it and how do you use it?
Well, so once you go through this fermentation, you're fermenting whole grains of rice. It's, again, not like wine where you squeeze out the juice and you ferment the juice. In the case of sake, you're fermenting whole rice grains. So when you're done and you take off the liquid, mm-hmm. you've got a lot of stuff left over. And the stuff that's left over are the remains of the rice grains, but also yeast cells and fungus cells and just all kinds of stuff. And the wonderful thing about the Japanese tradition, nothing goes to waste.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very rich source of flavor and of acidity, and it's just a very useful material for fermenting other things. For you can coat vegetables, meats, fish with sake lees, and depending on how long you do it, you can preserve them indefinitely, or you can just give them a wonderful flavor.
Right. So like vegetable pickles or the marinades and fish, traditional.
Yeah.
Right. And I heard that the sake lees can lower cholesterol. And that they're rich in vitamin B's and umami, and there's just so many good stuff going on in it. And I also heard that for kids, you can make a drink. It's sake lees, but it's not the alcohol.
Yes.
Alcoholic fruit. So you just put it in a little pot and warm up, and there's some sugar, and make a drink.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty healthy.
Ooh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah. And you can just put some in miso soup and make it even more flavorful.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, and always wonder, you know, the science of ikejime, which is a special technique to make fish tasty. It's traditional in Japan, and could you explain what it is and how it works?
Yes, so this is something that I learned about with Dave Arnold, who also has a show on Heritage Radio, and it was brought to our attention by Dave Chang, who wanted to know...
Of Momofuku.
Yes, how does this really work, and if so, how? And so we... Dave did most of the digging around, and it turns out that it's not that old a tradition. It goes back a few decades. And what it involves is when you catch a fish and it's still alive, what you do, instead of killing it in the usual way, and depending on the size of the fish, there are various ways of doing it, but you can bleed it, you can cut off the head, you can hit it in the head to knock it out. But in ikejime, what you do is you take a very thin wire and you insert it from the end of the tail up the spinal cord of the fish, and you move it around essentially to destroy the spinal cord. And what that does, it turns out, is immediately stop any kind of reflex muscle activity that would otherwise be taking place. The fish would be twitching and so on.
Because the nerves are broken, so the fish doesn't know I'm dead. Basically.
Yes, that's right. And not just the brain, but the whole body is now pretty much inert.
Mm.
And what that does is it prevents the fish muscle from using up all the fuel that it had stored in itself for swimming, which means that essentially the muscle is kind of alive for several days after you actually kill the fish, which means that it stays fresh much longer. Japanese tend to like the texture of their fish more firm mm-hmm. than we're used to in America, and the flesh does stay firm much longer than it does in traditional ways of slaughtering.
Right. Well, I heard even chicken and pork farmers, when they slaughter animals, and they suffer the taste, really, scientifically, you know, taste elements go down. Like, so it makes sense.
Yes.
And I think the Japanese fishermen, it's a norm. You know, they don't do, I heard, they don't do ikijime on every single fish, for if it's too small, it doesn't work.
It's difficult, yeah.
Right. But majority, if you go to Tsukiji market, you see people doing ikijime too. So, yeah, that's great. And I heard some fishermen in this country started to practice ikijime because it sells at a higher price.
Yes, yes.
Right.
And it really does keep better, so that, you know, you can say truck it to a restaurant that's further away and it won't suffer.
Right. And also it's considered to be the fastest and the most humane method of killing fish.
I'm not sure about fastest because it is difficult.
Oh, right.
but on many levels it's just a great improvement over the usual.
But is it hard for, say, this country's fishermen, or, you know, some chefs decided to get live fish and do ikijime? Is it very difficult?
It takes a while to learn, yes, because it's, you know, the end of the spinal cord is a very small, it's like a millimeter across or something like that, and you have to use a very thin wire, and the wire, because it's very thin, it can bend and then not go in, and so it just takes some training, like everything.
Right. But it's not impossible.
Oh, no.
Okay. And now I heard that you gave a lecture at the symposium in May 2015 at Ryukoku University in Kyoto, in Japan, and when they launched a new agricultural department. So what is the occasion? And, you know, it seems that the food science is getting more and more attention globally recently. So it seems like Japanese universities started to create a new department focusing on food and food science.
Right. Yes. So it was very exciting to me. I didn't know anything about Ryukoku University until I received an invitation to attend. Mm-hmm. And at first, I didn't think I was the right person, because it's a faculty of agriculture, and agriculture is it's an aspect of food, but not something I know a whole lot about. It turns out that the faculty of agriculture was designed in this new program to include not just agriculture, but food science, food technology, dietetics, plant breeding, animal breeding. And what they decided to do, because they were building it from scratch, was to put all these different programs into the same building and the same department. And it was just very exciting to see all these separate disciplines that usually don't talk to each other and just kind of operate in their own bubble, collaborating with each other. And labs and kitchens are right next to each other in this university. So it's, I think, a very exciting model for the future for how to really study food in an integrated way.
Sounds like the whole department covers the food chain of everything.
That was their ambition, yes.
So what did you talk about at the symposium?
Well, basically about how unusual this is. I talked a bit about the history of food science as a discipline, and how for a long time it was just kind of its own separate bailiwick, really only existing to help the food industry, not to help consumers at large, not to help restaurants or home chefs, home cooks. It was very specific and very narrow. And the wonderful thing that this program represents is a kind of broadening and opening up of the vision to realize that whether you're called a food technologist or a dietitian or an agriculturalist, you're all working on food. And so you should all be colleagues and work with each other.
Interesting. And have you seen similar programs in any place in the world?
No, That's the amazing thing, is that they had no food program to speak of to begin with, and they thought food is a very important aspect of our world. We need to do something. And they kind of thought from the very basics, if we're going to do this right, how should it look? What should it do? And they came up with this vision, and they've realized it. And it's really impressive, and I hope it'll be a model for the rest of the world.
Okay. And seems like the food science is becoming kind of more formalized to be studied.
Well, I would say actually maybe a little bit less formalized. You know, it's less food science with a capital F, capital S, and more study of food that even if you're not a scientist, you can appreciate aspects of the science and apply them in, if you're a cook or if you're a dietitian or if you're a plant breeder, make something delicious and not just something that's productive. That's the exciting thing, is the combination of perspectives.
Yeah, it's more approachable. Even I can think of it. And you give us the answers. So. Okay, so thank you for joining us today, Harold. And please come back.
My pleasure, Akiko. Thank you so much.
So, listeners, if you'd like to know more about Harold's work, please visit curiouscook.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And by the way, we just launched a beautiful new website, so please visit our page. And Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org and iTunes and iTunes podcast. Today's show was made possible by Santori, and our engineer is Jack Kingsley. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.